My name is Lena, and I am here with Harold Streitman. We are recording this interview in New York, New York. So, Harold, can you tell me a little bit about yourself? Where and when were you born?
Sure. I was born in New York City in Manhattan, and I was raised in Seagate in Brooklyn, which is a beach community west of Coney Island that's private, and actually the westernmost point of the entire New York shoreline. So we grew up really idyllically in a beach town, and that was a focal point of our upbringing there. Went to public school in Brooklyn and took the train into Manhattan with our family, one older brother, Lawrence, and came into town for Broadway shows and museum visits and restaurant visits, and I think a really classic New York upbringing in the 1950s and 60s. I attended NYU from 1968 till about 1972, and lived in the city beginning in around 1970. So at the start, I would take the train in from Brooklyn to Washington Square, which is the campus I attended, and I was studying fine arts, art history, but I majored in clinical psychology. And that was kind of a fascinating part of NYU because of its hospital presence in New York with the medical center, and being in the village with, at the time, an important hospital called St. Vincent's on 7th Avenue. I worked in both of those facilities for credit and worked in medical environments with psychiatrists, learning things in the field. So that was really fascinating. When I graduated, I really wanted to take a break from continuing education, and was living in the city on West 73rd Street, and took a job managing a friend's clothing store on East 60th Street near Bloomingdale's. Up until then, in my early years at NYU, clearly right in the middle of the West Village, there was a lot of time spent in Washington Square Park and all around the village, which in the late 60s, early 70s, certainly had a very strong gay presence. I was not out until, I guess, the middle of my school years, probably around 1969-1970. A friend from school took me for the first time to a gay bar at lunchtime between classes, and it still exists, and it's called Julius, and it's as much of a landmark as Stonewall is. I had never been to Stonewall as a customer. I really didn't yet go out to bars socially. It wasn't really my nightlife activity at that point. So Julius was the first experience even going into a gay bar. And then in the medical field with patients in St. Vincent's, which was a village, hospital, met a lot of gay clientele, both men and women, but there was that was not a social setting. When I was a teenager, younger, with my older brother, we were crazy about music and going out dancing, always. So when I got to be about 15, even 14, and Larry, 3 years older, would start to let me come into the city in his car with his friends. And most of the great clubs that they would go to, and they were all very gay friendly and had a mixed crowd of friends. I don't know, I knew I identified as gay, but it really wasn't talked about, even between my brother and I. But went to a lot of gay clubs with he and his friends, gay and mixed clubs, simply because they were the best clubs going on at the time. Some of them were called Tamburlaine, 12 West, Sanctuary, Everybody's. These were scattered all around the city. And that was a big eye-opener for me, just to see city life at night and get a taste of the different styles that were in different clubs. Each one kind of had a different personality. As it turns out, while I'm managing this clothing store called Trendmark, which was a Swedish brand, maybe comparable to something like The Gap here, I decided that opening a club would be a good idea. And in fact, I did that with, at the time, my boyfriend, Robert Boykin, who I had met that year in Washington Square Park. He wasn't an NYU student. And another friend, Arthur Weinstein, who I had met at a fashion show. The fashion show was at the Plaza Hotel for the designer Giorgio Santangelo, who I had met, and so I was invited to his show. Arthur was taking pictures, kind of like paparazzi, at this show, and he was very, very interesting character, looked great, very animated, and I stuck around and we just started this conversation, which led to a friendship for him to come by and hang out at the store on 60th Street. He had worked in a club for a short amount of time, not in any important position, maybe a bar back or something, but between the three of us, he was our professional experience. Mine was just the desire to create this as a project. Also because a club that I really liked, which was called The Loft, had burnt down. It was on Lower Broadway. And it was one of my favorite places to go, and I felt it was such a big loss. At the same time, I felt how difficult could it be to open a club. You need a space and a bar and great music. And sometimes when we're that naive and things lay out so simply, might be the best way to actually getting it off the ground. It certainly got a little more complicated than just that, but in about 20 months of having the first meeting in the apartment Robert and I shared on West 73rd Street, we started to get the ball rolling to open a discotheque. And we ended up in a space on 62nd Street and Broadway, which at the time was a six-story corner building that were dance rehearsal studios for Broadway and Lincoln Center. And the fantastic thing about them is they had no vertical columns in them so that you could rehearse an entire company at once. And one of these spaces which I understand was quite a famous dance studio called Luigi's on the second floor, became available. We weren't particularly looking for any neighborhood. It's sort of like if you open a restaurant and the food is good, people will go anywhere. So it was an odd place to open a club. Many were downtown. Other clubs at the time were Flamingo, still 12 West, La Mouche, New York, New York. Studio 54 had not yet opened. Xenon had not yet opened. Mud Club had not yet opened. And we really weren't modeling it off of anything other than a very modern idea of a New York crowd that was high-low, sort of meeting in the middle in a beautiful, simple location. So high-low really was something that continued in my mind all along. So you had, in the 1970s, a very defined downtown scene. And it was not only logistically downtown, it was a culture of downtown. We didn't yet spread out to Brooklyn, although people lived everywhere around the city. The island of Manhattan really composed all of it. And so places like the East Village and Lower East Side and other parts of Lower West Side were still entry-level places in New York where students and theater people, artists of any type, foreigners, and all young people could still come to New York on kind of an entry level, which had been going on in New York City since it became a destination to come here with a dream and find some housing and a roommate and whatever and become a star, right? So at the same time, you had uptown social scene, a more established society, but that had been changing because in the 1970s, New York was in a huge economic downturn and real estate became very inexpensive. And because of that, you had a big influx of European and South American people coming to buy real estate because the prices were really great. And many of these were young people. And suddenly New York had this fantastic mix in the night scene of Brazilians and French and people from Venezuela, people from Mexico, people from Germany, all hanging out in New York. Because of our spontaneity in getting things rolling very quickly with the club, I reached out to people I knew already in the city who were well known in the fashion world. Designers like Calvin Klein and Giorgio Sant'Angelo, people in the modeling business, photographers, all shared their lists with me. Honestly, they were Rolodexes or address books at that time. We had no tech devices, and that's how you compiled a mailing list. It was interesting that without even trying, it was a gay and straight list mixed, and there again becomes this combustion of social energy when you have drag queens from the Lower East Side with Park Avenue socialites who are all absolutely having a ball with each other. And it took about 20 months to open the club. We were packed, overpacked the opening night. The police closed Broadway and 62nd Street because of the amount of people that responded to the opening invitations. And fortunately for us, it was a huge hit right off the bat. We got a tremendous amount of press because it was these three young guys who'd never done anything like that. The gay spirit in New York had changed a lot and added to the success of this project. Stonewall had only happened a couple of years before we opened the club. I was not a regular Village bar goer, but certainly knew the Stonewall and knew what had happened. I would say that myself and my friends felt pretty openly gay growing up in our teens and early 20s in New York, but yes, there was apprehension if you were doing something very late at night on a deserted street coming home from a club or a bar, that you sort of had your wits about you. And being native New Yorkers, you sort of feel like you can figure all that out instinctively, but at the same time, there were people who were getting into trouble with running into gay bashing kind of situations. I had never had an experience of being accused or someone acting aggressively to me, specifically because I may have come off gay. So I personally never felt that. I guess I also living on Upper West Side, then moving to Midtown on the East Side, I was in fairly residential neighborhoods that were relatively safe for New York City. I didn't live at this time, the Lower East Side or even East Village were still kind of dicey neighborhoods, but great neighborhoods, and still some of the greatest neighborhoods. So the idea that we were mixing these social spheres of New York and overlapping them in this space really allowed people to be quite expressive, and we had performances in the club. They were often gay performances. There was the great performer Divine, who ran three shows in our club on a stage with the producer Ron Feld. So we were very active in the gay social life at that time that did feel in the 70s very free to be expressed. At the same time, the clubs downtown were, I think, similarly very popular, and there were two or three very big gay clubs in those times that some were membership, some were just hard to get into, but I'm thinking of the Saint and Flamingo in particularly, that also reflected a lot of the summertime social scene in the Pines on Fire Island. The Pines on Fire Island was a really important part of gay New Yorkers leaving any tension in the city of kind of having a feeling that you still had to look over your shoulder. That didn't go away with Stonewall. It may have just given you an option to turn around and face the person you felt might be suspicious about you. I think that was a big change for me. So Fire Island Pines and Cherry Grove became really a destination for gay men and women and trans men and women to feel very safe and express their culture, which might be a very outrageous way of behavior, or just simply being with your friends and cooking dinner and hanging out at the beach and kind of having a regular good time. So kind of running the range of any group of people. not necessarily different because they were gay. So I started to go out to the Pines in the same years that we opened Hurrah, and the house that I rented was with a couple of the DJs that worked at Hurrah, but these DJs also rotated throughout all the clubs. We didn't have the same DJ every night. They also often worked at the clubs in the Pines and Cherry Grove. So the Fire Island was really like the summertime backyard of the New York nightlife and gay scene. And really was a place to develop the culture of what took place for the rest of the year in the city. I stayed with the club for about 2.5 years. It was an incredible experience for me. And when you're 21 and 22, and in those years, you kind of have this stamina that you can throw a party every night and stay out till 6 o'clock in the morning. And we often went out, when we closed the club, to other clubs downtown. I started to really want to think about what the next step would be. Some of the scene in New York was changing to the punk scene. CBGB's had opened, the Mud Club had opened, and when you have a venue, when you have a club, basically you've got to get people in there and pay whatever admission and go to the bar and buy a drink. Otherwise you're not in business. So Hurrah's had to change with the times. It started, of course, in the glory days of disco music, and that had to change. And the culture to which it needed to change was not, at the time, really what appealed to me. I ended up going abroad and spending some time in Paris. And there was a fantastic kind of mini New York scene going on in Paris at the same time in the 70s, with two or three really great dance bars and nightclubs happening. And like clubs anywhere in the world, the people who go out are a lot of art people, fashion people, and I met a lot of people in the great world of fashion in Paris, and came back to New York with a recommendation letter to Yves Saint Laurent menswear office here in New York, and ended up getting a job in the PR and advertising department there, and that led to about the next 30 odd years working in menswear. So without even knowing from my days at NYU to always having interest in clothes and in fashion, but and particularly in design, the precision that it takes for design, that I ended up having this career in menswear, which was sensational. And I was able to work for some really great companies in those years, including Calvin Klein, Saks Fifth Avenue, and Abercrombie and Fitch. In the early 2000s, I wanted to become more interested in architecture and interior design, and left the menswear business, but still did some consulting, but started to design textiles, which I'd always done in the menswear field, but more for interiors and to actually design interiors. And oddly, around this time where my whole interest was about precision and design and making things to fit perfectly in the environment, my eyesight began to fail. And that started in the late 1990s through an HIV-related virus called CMV. And pretty early on, I lost most of the vision in my right eye, but had pretty good function in my left eye. So in terms of color and design and volume and every other thing we do throughout the day, including travel and measuring, all the quite specific things you do in design, I was able to do pretty well. The interior design was really a great extension from actually the world of fashion and the people who work in it, and the freedom kind of to be a gay man in those two fields early on. If we're still talking about Stonewall and the history there, we keep hearing in the documentaries this past week about the difficulty of people even going to bars if they worked in the quote-unquote straight world, and someone might take a picture or recognize them, and I don't know, maybe they worked in a law firm or the medical field or some kind of industry where they had to pass in order to remain there. And, you know, in hindsight, I feel so privileged that I kind of had an easier path because of the fields that maybe are considered somewhat more creative and art-driven, that sexuality really wasn't looked on negatively. I think a very important aspect of the arc of time that I've lived through of 60s, 70s, my education and starting my work career till now has really left an impact of the change of behavior and the gay culture in New York. The kind of hyper-sexual community that existed in the 70s and 80s that ended up creating the epidemic of HIV/AIDS is something that I still think about because I was very much part of it, owning a nightclub. There was a lot of sexual behavior that seemed to be a needed expression of the change of freedom, of being a closeted community, really throughout the decades, up until 1969. So this dramatic change in behavior sadly enhanced the spread of the epidemic. At the same time, the legal aspects of being gay were slowly changing with the energy of the gay movement coming out of Stonewall. Things like your rights to have an apartment and have employment beyond an accusation of your sexuality. As we know today, through the Human Rights Commission, especially, that there are states to this day, especially in the South, where that protection does not exist yet. So this brings to mind new generations of LGBTQ population that are much more informed about sexual practices and their behavior, and many of whom grew up without ever having known a lifetime of AIDS before, or the struggle to lose or keep your apartment or your job. And that's an absolutely wonderful achievement. At the same time, the idea that we don't educate our younger populations, gay and straight, of what the movement that arose out of Stonewall created, facilitated the seemingly free society we live in today, though we know through our present administration and a national feeling of polarization that certainly some of that freedom is a myth. And so I often talk to many of my young friends that my partner Jean and I have in our, and treasure, by the way, our friends who are in their 20s and 30s, about the history. And of course, most all are very, very interested to know that. And I hope there's more education within the gay community to bring together millennials and X-Gen and other groups to watch the films that we've all seen proliferating this month, and to make sure everyone gets to have a sense of the arc of time and the momentum and how many, many people worked so hard to get to this point in time. Further to that, this Sunday, in conjunction with the World Pride March on Fifth Avenue, there's a terrific march that might be called an alternative one, called Reclaim Pride, which will happen also on Sunday, marching up Sixth Avenue to Central Park to a rally. And the idea of this came about through different gay groups and LGBTQ groups around the city and around the country, actually, in the past 2 years, to have a march that's about gay rights and gay activism without any commercial aspect of a parade, and especially the Gay Pride Parade. Gay Pride Parade is a monumental event in New York City, as we all know, and thereby has some feel been co-opted by a corporate presence. So you may see floats from Verizon or Capital One or other corporations that are clearly taking advantage of the huge audience in the crowd, the televised presence of the parade, but maybe we're not quite sure about what their views about me as a gay man might be as an employee in their company, in terms of my protection in my job, my healthcare rights, my ability to have my partner participate, etc. So the Gay Pride March maybe could be likened now to the Thanksgiving Day Parade and other great New York events, but have we somewhat lost the initial idea of the march that happened just after Stonewall, where spontaneously, a group started marching. This is, I believe, 4 days after the riot, marching up 6th Avenue near Christopher Street. And there maybe were a couple of dozen. And by the time they reached Central Park, there were a couple of thousand. And this was unorganized and quite very much an activist rally. There was not an enormous amount of spectacle to it, but there was a tremendous amount of energy and coming together as a community. And to speak about the inequalities that still existed, certainly just days after Stonewall. So Reclaim Pride is going to be a revisit to that spirit, marching up 6th Avenue without the other aspects of a parade, and to talk about issues today that still exist to a large degree in many parts of the country. We can often in New York City start getting a little myopic in our experience that things here are quite unique, maybe in other big cities around the country, certainly on the coasts, that don't exist in Middle America or the Deep South. So we're hoping that this march on Sunday really gets an enormous amount of attention, at least as much as the wonderful parade that will be going concurrently down Fifth Avenue as we march up to Central Park to rally. So having said that, happy Pride.
Happy Pride.
Yes.
And with these last few minutes we have left, is there anything else you would like to share?
Well, I guess the last thing to share is just to thank everyone who might hear this, who would know who they are, who've been tremendously supportive to me, especially most recently when I had a complete vision loss, and have recognized that their friendship and attention is a huge part of what keeps me unchanged in spirit and my goals every single day. So a huge appreciation is how I'd like to end. Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you for speaking with me today.
You're welcome.